would guesstimate at 4 to 5% that the wisdom teeth actually come in straight and they are functional. Now, of that 4 to 5%, I would say only about 2% can ever keep them clean. And so later on in life, they end up being extracted anyway. So here's the other caveat. And, you know, Dr. Kavitsko, I'm sure you can remember when you sprain your ankle as a 16-year-old and give yourself 2 days and you're out running around again.
Right.
You know, now we do that. I hobble around for a couple months. So, you know, as we get older, it takes us longer to heal and recover. The younger patients just do much, much better.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Not only that, the teeth aren't completely formed, so they're smaller, easier to get out. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll probably add something to that. Here's a little bit of news. In fact, this is a company that's based here in Ohio, in Columbus. It's been discovered that there are quantities of stem cells that are actually in your wisdom teeth. And, there's...
I didn't realize that. So when the tooth is extracted, they can be harvested from the capsule?
Absolutely.
Okay, now the capsule is a soft tissue capsule, for lack of a better word. Not supposed to use the definition of the word in the word. But anyway, it's surrounded by... The end of the tooth has this capsule of tissue on it, and that has all the instructions needed to form the rest of the tooth. It originally had all the instructions needed to form the whole tooth.
Right.
And then as the tooth forms, it kind of moves down the tooth a little bit until at the very end, when they're 16, it's just at the very end. But there's stem cells, so that's really cool. Now, you talked about healing and hobbling around for a couple months. You must be healthier than me because it takes me half a year to recover from things. But anyway, no. I'm sure you know this, but when there is tissue injury, even in a 90-year-old, you develop the same amount of growth hormone as you did when you were a kid. So our body has the ability to heal even when we're older.
Right.
And growth hormone is one of the major components of healing, apparently, as we're learning. There are other factors, though, growth factors or hormones involved in that the research for implants has discovered. And can you tell me a little bit about, we're getting ahead of ourselves because we haven't talked about implants yet, but it is a part of healing. And how does a 90-year-old heal at all when you think about it? Because everything else is maybe not functioning as well as they were when they were 16. You know, kidneys aren't functioning as well, liver's not functioning as well, lungs aren't functioning as well, and yet people in their 80s and 90s can get injured and still heal.
That's correct. As we get older, there are a number of chemical components that float in our bloodstream which help us to heal. And these are stem cells, so they're pluripotent, which means they can change to either nerve or tissue or bone. And as we get older, the number of these cells drops significantly. And there have been a number of techniques that are trying to isolate these host of chemicals and put these in wounds and be able to grow bone in a shorter amount of time and promote healing in a shorter amount of time.
Do you see the day when we'll have isolated these and you say extract a wisdom tooth in an older individual and then you apply this material?
Oh, absolutely. And extracting wisdom teeth in older individuals, I find that, there's always a bony defect. The literature says that after the age of 25, you don't deposit as much bone behind that second molar. And when that happens, then it becomes a food trap in the backside of that second molar. So, if we had a chemical or a substance or a medium that we could place in this socket and encourage bony healing, that would be fantastic. And those things are on the horizon.
Okay. Well, I think that's pretty exciting because it'll allow us to help the people that maybe need some kind of a surgical procedure. Maybe they do need a third molar removed and they're 30 because it's become infected, and we can help them heal a little quicker, maybe make it less traumatic. The other thing, you said when you were describing oral and maxillofacial surgeons, I think you said, did you say under the skin? When you were giving your definition, the structures under the skin?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, and basically, that is, if you change the structures under the skin, you've changed the shape of a person's face, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you can consider, it's like moving the foundation of your house. So when things are too large or too small, we can augment bone or remove bone. And when you do that, you can oftentimes change the facial features of an individual.
Right. So it's In the process of correcting their malocclusions, it winds up being a little bit of plastic surgery.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. So, in fact, oral surgeons and plastic surgeons kind of have this crossover where you both would be educated in the field and able to perform the same procedure.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, there are even some oral surgeons that sort of subspecialize, and they do nothing but cosmetic facial surgery.
I want to talk a little bit more about that when we come back from the break, but we do have to go to a break. You are listening to AM 1230, WYTS, Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kavitko, and we'll be right back. AM 1230 WYTS. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kavitko. Thank you for joining me this morning. My guest today is Dr. Tim Troiano, who is a board-certified oral and maxillofacial surgeon in private practice here in Columbus. Dr. Troiano, we were talking about factors that might help healing, and then we started talking about the cosmetic, the fact that what oral surgeons do is pretty much plastic surgery, even though you're doing it for the jaw structures, and how that kind of overlaps what plastic surgeons do. So how do you, if somebody doesn't like their facial profile, how do they know whether they should choose to go to an oral surgeon or a plastic surgeon? What kinds of things should they consider?
Well, if this is a bony deformity, you know, it's kind of interesting. Most patients can't see their own profile. And
but they've been told they have a big nose or a small chin or something, or they, you know, maybe their family traits are that. So then they want help. So how would they choose?
Usually you're looking at either the cosmetic profession or oral surgery. And if it's a bony issue, oral surgery would probably be the best direction to go. As I said, we're dealing more with moving bones around. There are some oral surgeons that strictly do, as I said, here in town, just facial cosmetic surgery. My practice isn't really developed around that. I promote more of the moving of the bones and establishing a good occlusion or bite for the patients.
There's also oral surgeons I've heard that do Botox.
Yes, yes. Okay. Botox is, it's really neat stuff. It really does work. It can't fix everything, but it's great around the forehead and around the eyes. I mean, I've been doing Botox injections since 1997. So Botox, Restylane, collagen, and people say, well, you know, what do you do? You know, why are you doing that? And I said, well, you know, there's no other profession that does more injections than we do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I actually had it demonstrated to me, and I was told that it would be legal for me to do, although I've decided to not put that into my bag of tricks, so to speak. I think I'll leave that to the oral surgeons. Let you guys handle that. So you do that on a regular basis, and that lasts 3 months, I hear?
3 to 4 months, yeah.
3 to 4 months. So there are people then that come every third or fourth month and get re-injected with Botox?
Yeah, I have my repeat offenders.
Is there a reason to do that over, say, the tissue surgery? Because you said you deal in mostly bones. So if a person was coming for crow's feet, you know, by your eyes, do you do that?
I have been trained to do that, but I don't do things like blepharoplasties or rhinoplasties.
Okay.
So I leave that out of my repertoire.
But if somebody just has the lines on the outside of each eye?
Well, that's the nice thing about Botox is there's really no downtime. There's very little complications, and it really works. It takes 2 or 3 days for it to finally kick in, but I think most patients are amazed at how well it works.
So the patient says, I don't like my facial profile, and if they have to know in advance that it could be corrected by bone surgery as opposed to soft tissue surgery. I'm still getting back to how would a patient select between a plastic surgeon and an oral and maxillofacial surgeon?
Oftentimes, our patients, either cosmetically or orthodontically, are referred from another specialist or a GP. So that's primarily how we see our patients.
So most people don't go to the phone book and say, I want my face to look different, I'm going to go to a neurosurgeon?
I think it's important for patients to be educated and do a little research on their own. And, you know, opening up the Yellow Pages is not necessarily the best way to do that. you should ask around, talk to some of your friends, and see a number of doctors. The important thing is to be comfortable with the doctor that you meet, whether it be plastics or ENT or oral maxillofacial surgeon.
Okay. So if you don't have a family physician and you think you need some cosmetic enhancements, you could ask your dentist if you have one, and or you could ask your physician. If you ask your physician, you'll probably get referred to a plastic surgeon. If you ask your dentist, you'll get referred to an oral surgeon, probably.
Sometimes I get referrals from both.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. What's your favorite procedure to do in the office?
Oh, boy. I would have to say that actually implant placement is probably the most enjoyable and the most beneficial for the patient.
Right, yeah, we're going to talk a lot about that here in a little bit, because it's not only the wave of the future, but it's the wave now. I mean, there are so many, in fact, we don't even extract a tooth without preparing the socket for a future implant, even if the person isn't saying they want one yet.
Yeah, oftentimes, yes.
Yeah. Okay, all right, so just so that you know then, oral surgeons can do some cosmetic surgery. It doesn't always have to be because you have a malocclusion.
Correct.
Okay. Now, how do you, what do you do if somebody has no chin? I mean, you know what I'm talking about, that weak chin. What do you do?
Well, there are a number of things that can be done, and this would be done under general anesthetic. Sometimes it can be done in an office setting, but oftentimes it's brought to the hospital. And we do either chin implants underneath the gum tissue and kind of plump that chin up, or we can actually cut a piece of the chin and advance it and then secure it with titanium plates and screws.
So a chin implant is an artificial piece of something?
Yeah, you have to be aware that there's a number of procedures that can be done. You just can't use one procedure for every patient. So different situations demand different techniques.
Okay. So we're going to have to go to a break. When we come back, though, I want to get a little more detail on, I know you can use their own bone, you slice a little piece off, basically, and move it forward and hold it there with screws, but what the other materials are made out of and are they safe and all of that. But before we go to break, let me just had a couple emails of people who gave questions, or rather their guests, to our question of the day. And the question of the day was, according to a Dr. Barrett Sexton, a Memphis oral surgeon, what percent of patients simply don't have room in their jaws to accommodate wisdom teeth? Michael sent us an email of 46%. Ben sent us an email saying 78%. And Christy sent in an email that says 62%. Those are not correct, but please keep your guesses coming. So we will give out the answer later in the day, and I'm going to ask Dr. Tarano to guess as well. These are not hard and fast numbers, because unless we lined everybody up at once and checked, we would not know, but they're pretty educated guesses. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back. AM 1230 WYTS, you're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Our show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but we're too numb to ask. Thanks for joining me this morning. We're talking to Dr. Tim Troiano, an oral surgeon right here in Columbus. He's also a faculty member at The Ohio State University College of Dentistry. And before the break, we were talking about building up a chin and chin implants. Before I get to that discussion, Dr. Troiano, I do want to I mentioned to my listeners that most of you have discovered that the station format has changed, and so if you were to try to go to my podcast page, you would not be able to at this point, but the shows are still available by podcast, or will be again soon, including this one. So please stay tuned every Sunday morning at 9, and as soon as we have the instructions to find our podcast page, we will let you know. Something else you could do, if you would like, is you could send an email. Maybe send it to drkvitko@aol.com, and my staff will be happy to keep your name. And as soon as we know, we'll send you an email that tells you how to access the podcasts. And including Dr. Troiano, this show will be available for you, too, if we can ever figure out how to get to it. All right. So the chin implant. You mentioned that you prefer to use the patient's own bone, but there are other options out there, and I'm just curious about what they are and what your experience with them have been.
We can sometimes use even cadaver bone, so from a human donor. Some individuals have used small blocks of bovine or cow bone. And there are some synthetic chin implants or cheek implants that are out there as well.
Okay. And of the two non-natural, like when you're not using the patient's own bone, which of those other two do you prefer?
The cadaver bone seems to be very well tolerated and predictable. The other is the Porex implants that I personally choose to use.
Porex is an artificial material?
It is artificial.
Okay.
And it has a porous matrix to it so that the soft tissue and bone actually grows right into it afterwards.
Okay, and it stays in, it's not removed later, but it becomes very much incorporated with the bone.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, because I know I have some patients who, when I do my socket preservation, they have a problem with the notion that maybe a cadaver, a human, someone else's bone is going to be in them. Kind of scary to them, and the same. And then there's this another group of people that don't want cow bone in
yes.
them. I have both in the office on purpose so they can pick, and I assure them that in the case of both of those, that their own bone will replace this bone within about a year,
or sometimes less.
Sometimes less. Yeah. So a year from now, or less than a year from now, they no longer have that foreign bone in their body. But with the simplex, you called it.
It's more of a Porex.
Porex. That it's kind of like having a knee replaced, which is a combination of Teflon and titanium. In the chin case, it stays there.
But yeah, and we can also do that for cheek implants as well.
Really? Now, so besides chin implants and that sort of thing, corrective jaw surgery, you also do cleft lip and palate surgeries, correct?
In my hospital training, we did a fair amount of cleft lip and cleft palate. These are usually very intensive and usually surrounded by a cleft palate team, which may include some plastic surgeons, oral surgeons, orthodontics, because it's really multidisciplinary. And currently here in Columbus, I don't do those because I'm not a member of a team.
I see. And is it a federal law, state law that says when a cleft palate left lip patient is born, that within a certain number of months, it has to be corrected?
I don't know if that's a mandate, but I know these are all reported, that the reporting has to be mandated. But depending on the situation, there are different time frames when cleft lip and cleft palates are repaired. So they may not be repaired at birth. They may have to wait some time.
Sometime meaning years?
Or? Yes, years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And without getting too technical, I can't explain the time frame when these things mean.
Okay. That's surprising to me because I thought they were all taken care of at a very young age in this country. Now we know in other countries, especially developing countries, they don't have those teams that you're describing, and they're not able to care for these people, and they just grow up to be adults who have this appearance, they have trouble swallowing. I mean, food gets in the airway easily. There's all kinds of... And the difference between cleft lip and cleft palate, you don't always have both, right?
And that's why I say this gets a little confusing, because there can be combinations of both, and there's different criteria as to the amount of clefting.
So a child could be born with just a cleft lip, and it doesn't affect their gums, their bone underneath, and therefore maybe not even their teeth. That would be a later stage. And what we're talking about is in an embryologic development... The later the little tick or mistake happens, the better it is for the individual, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So that you have these two, they're called branchial arches that close, or are they clefts?
As the palatal shelves, they'll migrate and eventually grow together. So mm-hmm. there's various levels when these ridges may be elevated and don't fully migrate. So that's really where the problem lies.
Okay. And if you've ever seen a cleft palate, cleft lip, patient who has not had it corrected, it's very, very sad. And the ones that have had it corrected, they still have a little bit of scarring, but very much a normal appearance these days.
Yeah, and this follows a wide spectrum because there's some clefts that are very small, some that are very large, some that may incorporate bone, others do not. So again, without getting too technical, there's a wide spectrum to their repair.
Okay. But again, that all falls under the purview of an oral and maxillofacial surgeon. So what sort of facial trauma then, trauma surgery, does oral maxillofacial surgeons address? So you got a car accident, and you're taken to the hospital, and it's facial trauma. That would they then call an oral surgeon?
It, sometimes it depends on what specialty is on call for trauma, but generally plastics, ENT, and oral maxillofacial surgery, those are the three disciplines that really follow facial trauma. And, you know, there can be varying degrees of facial trauma, whether it just be skin or tissue, a lower jaw, an upper jaw. The important thing is, and, you know, I think that oral surgeons have always looked at the dentition as the foundation for reconstruction. Doctor, I'm sure you've had patients that have had just a filling that's just a little bit too high, and you say, God, this is just driving me crazy. Well, that's just a, you know, a few microns.
Right.
So, you know, we always, when we reconstruct a skeleton, we always start from the dentition first and move up.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Other disciplines don't necessarily do that. So.
Right. Yeah, I want to expand on that in just a minute. It is time to go to another break. So please stay with us. Remember to send us your emails to dentallyspeakingontalk1230@yahoo.com. Phone number is 821-1230. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko, and we'll be right back after the break.
So hear me when I'm saying, smiling faces.
Welcome back. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko here on AM 1230 WYTS. Thanks for joining me. We're talking today with Dr. Tim Troiano, who is an oral surgeon right here in Columbus. And we're able to ask questions of him about the kinds of things oral surgeons do and the considerations you should think of before deciding whether you want to have your treatment performed by an oral surgeon, by a plastic surgeon, or by your regular dentist. Now, one of the things we were talking about was facial trauma, and Dr. Troiano had mentioned how oral surgeons start their thought process with the foundation being how do the teeth align? What is the occlusion? How do those teeth come together? And if you don't do that, you can run into some problems where a person's bones are maybe put back together and a person maybe looks normal, but they can't chew. Their mouth is maybe propped open. Have you ever seen a case like that, Dr. Troiano?
Actually, quite a few.
You have. So then what happens? Do you have to go in and do an entirely new surgery?
If it's early enough, oftentimes we can go in and just move it around and then refix the position. But if the bone is already healed, which is really at about the 5 to 6 week period, you may have to re-break those bones to make them fit properly.
So I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that if it were me and I had an option and I was in a car accident, I would probably request an oral surgeon for that reason. Now, you know, I'm tainted because I'm a dentist, but I would want my family to choose an oral surgeon. And if you happen to be in a car accident and maybe you're the person injured and can't speak for yourself, but maybe if you let your family members know that you've heard from Dr. Kvitko that would be the best way to go. You are allowed to request what type of a specialist is treating you, if you can speak, of course.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So if there's two of you in the car and one can talk and one can't, just say, hey, we'd like an oral surgeon to be involved in this. And I think maybe the results from a dental standpoint will be a whole lot better.
Well, actually, there have been a number of surgeries where either plastics or ENT is covering some trauma, and they give us a call, say, hey, would you come up and take a look at this, because we're not quite sure, and we give them a hand. And
good, good, good. So, because we all kind of know our limitations, and a physician's training in dentistry amounts to maybe a one-hour lecture or something. I don't know for sure.
Probably.
if we're lucky. It's kind of like hygienists think that dentists can't clean teeth because they spend two or four years figuring it out, and we don't. But
right.
But I can clean teeth. I just don't do it very much. Anyway, okay, now I want to get on to implants. Implants is not only the wave of the future, but it's the wave of now, and it can do so many things for us. It used to be, when I was in dental school, there was early research being done back in the mid-70s on baboons, both at OSU and at Battelle, and the early research wasn't very promising, and I know as a dental student, I wondered if we'd ever have dental implants, and now they have a better success rate than root canals. And I actually place implants, so it's becoming something that is so commonplace that, however, when it comes to somebody who gets 13, 15 implants, of course, that's probably something more up your alley.
You said something really interesting that kind of caught me. As a point of interest, you said the baboon studies that were being done here. Now, Dr. Kvitko, I know my father is an oral surgeon, but my father was actually in on those.
He was?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really
And they're originally ceramic, and he has a bunch of them sitting in his drawer.
Oh, that's cool.
And when it came time for the new blade implant.
Yes, endosseous blade, right?
Yeah. Actually, my father placed the first implant here in Columbus back in 1967.
Wow.
So they've been around. They are not experimental. You always hear, you know, your insurance company wants to tell you, oh, they're experimental, and that's not the case.
Right, right. I didn't realize the first blade was 1967. I tell my patients who are kind of lamenting that their insurance doesn't cover it, and I say, you know, how many more decades are we going to have these things before the insurance companies are forced to admit that they're no longer investigational? That's the word they like to use.
Yes.
They don't use experimental because they know they can't get away with that one anymore.
Right.
But investigational still keeps them from having to pay for them, apparently. So, do you happen to have, I'm curious, could you get us photographs of those early implants that you said your dad has in his drawer?
Oh, yeah, sure.
If you could email me a photo, I'd love to put it up on the website. We can do that, Tom, right? Assuming we, once we get access to the website again, they're building it. But no, that'd be great. And, you can send that to drkavitko@aol.com. Would be great. And
beautiful.
We'll put those up. We have some photos of a polar bear in the middle of a root canal. One of our former guests is a veterinary dentist, and I think that's really neat. And we learn so much from our guests. I learn so much from showing up at work every day. I imagine you're the same. So, implants. Tell me what do I need to know about implants? Tell me all the neat things that are happening. And I'm going to, honestly, I think what we'll do is save that till we come back from the break, and then I'm going to give you 5 minutes to tell me everything there is about implants, okay? All right.
Sounds great. Thanks.
We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS.
You make me smile, please stay for a while now. Just take your time wherever you go.
AM 1230 WYTS. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kavitko. Thank you for joining me. Today we've been speaking with oral surgeon Dr. Tim Triano, and we are going to talk with him about implants in the last segment here of the hour, and it's actually 7 minutes before the hour, almost six. And but before we do, I want to not only give out the question of the day again, remind you what the question was, but ask Dr. Triano for his guess, and then I'll give you the answer. So the question of the day, and we have one more guest, by the way, one more guest came in from Wade, but the question is, according to Dr. Barrett Sexton, a Memphis oral surgeon, what percent of patients simply do not have room in their jaws to accommodate their wisdom teeth? Now, Wade guessed 92%. Wade, that's not correct. And Dr. Triano, your guess?
I'd say 90%.
Okay, very close. See, he is an expert. According to this surgeon, and we also mentioned that we know these aren't exact, he estimated 85%. So you guys are in the ballpark, and that's a high, high number. So your chances are really, really good of having to have your wisdom teeth removed.
Yes.
Okay, implants. I promised you a segment to tell me everything we need to know about implants, and I apologize that we're a little bit out of time, but maybe somewhere down the road we can have you back if you'd like.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay. All right, so I'm a patient. I'm thinking about, I've heard about implants. I have a missing tooth, or I'm thinking about having a tooth extracted. What should I know about implants?
Well, the first thing I give them is just a couple numbers, and that is, and these studies are about 15 years old. There are three different studies on two different continents, and there's a success rate of 92 to 94% in the upper jaw and 96 to 98% success in the lower jaw. Now, what does that mean? These were 10-year studies, and so they stopped following these patients after 10 years. So either they moved, they died, or just didn't want to come back. But what this says is those high numbers kept their implants 10 years or longer. So that's pretty good numbers, pretty good success.
It is. So you're the patient, you're thinking about getting one. The answer is they're safe, they last, and they're cost-effective, and they are kinder to the teeth, meaning if you have an implant placed where you lose a tooth, we don't have to grind down the teeth on either side.
Yeah, that's absolutely is.
Now, how many, what about, and obviously I know this answer, but I want to ask you to just explain it. You can't have an implant bridge, or a bridge that runs from an implant to a natural tooth. Why is that?
There's actually a ligament around that tooth, and it kind of almost acts like a shock absorber. So the implant does not have that. So years ago when they were doing these implants, they were joining implants to tooth, and since there's a differential in the movement, it would end up either breaking the implant or breaking the tooth. So no, we cannot join an implant to a tooth.
Okay. So if you're missing a bunch of teeth in a row, you can either have a bunch of implants, individual implants placed, or you can have one at each end and a bridge made between the two.
That is correct.
And what's your preference? What would you like to see? If you had your choice, you're doing a treatment plan for a patient, and they're missing four teeth in a row, what would you, let's say it's the posterior area, all of their chewing teeth on the lower right, what would you like to see there?
Well, you know, of course I leave that up to the patient, and I tell them, you know, if we do a sort of a bridged implant prosthesis, this still means that you still will trap some food underneath that bridge, you're going to have to direct attention cleaning underneath that bridge. If we do four individual implants, then you just have to clean in between each implant, which is sometimes a little bit nicer. But some patients may be restricted economically.
Now, why is it so hard to place implants in the upper arch?
Well, embryologically, the upper jaw actually comes from a different cell. And the bone there is actually a little softer, a little more spongy, gives a little more. So we usually have to wait a little bit longer for those implants to fuse in the upper jaw.
Okay, so it's not that it's harder, although you do have the sinus that you have to lift at times, but it just takes longer to heal.
That's correct.
But didn't you say the success rate in the upper jaw is greater?
Actually, a little bit less, and it's probably because of that more spongy bone.
Okay, I guess I heard it backwards then. Okay, I was thinking that. I thought the lower arch was one that would last and be more predictable. So, Dr. Troiano, thank you so much for being on the show. We have about 15 seconds to go, and so I better not ask you any more questions. But yeah, if you're willing to be on the show again, we will set that up for some point down the line, because I know this is a question a lot of people have. All right, you've been listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230. I said it wrong, AM 1230, WYTS. And join in me next Sunday at 9. Thank you.